Chapter 1. Maleficia. The Afflicted. The first to be hanged was Bridget Bishop. She was a tavern owner in her early 60s and had never met her accusers until she faced them in court. In many ways, she was an obvious target. Rumours of witchcraft had followed Bishop for a decade or more. Her manner of dress had always seemed ostentatious. Her red paragon bodice was even cited as evidence against her. She ran two taverns, or ordinaries, where late-night carousing was apparently encouraged. Whether the reputation was deserved or not, Bishop's establishments were perceived as fleshpots of debauchery, which marred the general sobriety of Salem and its environs. The chief accusers were a group of young girls who would perform their histrionics in court to the horror of magistrates, ministers, families, and friends. As Bishop took the stand, the girls writhed and screamed as though possessed, claiming that Bishop did oftentimes very grievously pinch them, choke them, bite them, and afflict them. One girl, Susanna Sheldon, insisted that she had witnessed Bishop suckling a snake. Other villagers testified that she had urged them to sign the devil's book. It was said that she had lately been sending out her shape at night to haunt the bedchambers of local men. Sometimes they recognised her flashy attire through the shadows, but she had occasionally manifested in the guise of a black pig or an unnatural hybrid of chicken, monkey, and human. It was alleged that she took revenge on those men who rejected her advances. The premature deaths of some of their children was taken as proof of her malefic powers. During these trials, the girls would often imitate the gestures of the accused, as though they were the merest marionettes to the witch's diabolical wills. So as Bishop rolled her eyes in exasperation at the display before her, the girls simultaneously did the same, thereby proving that she had seized control of their bodies. Accustomed as she was to allegations of witchcraft, contemporary reports of Bishop's trial suggest a woman who was not so much defiant as bewildered. "I am innocent to a witch," she said to the magistrates. "I know not what a witch is." 8 days after her conviction, on the 10th of June 1692, she was taken to Gallows Hill and hanged from the great oak tree. The witch trials of Salem, Massachusetts, lasted a little over a year, but hold a particular fascination to this day as a case study in communal hysteria. Partly, this is because accounts of the court sessions and the aftermath make for such compelling reading. From Cotton Mather's The Wonders of the Invisible World, 1693, to Daniel A. Gagnon's A Salem Witch, 2021. The claims of the girls were the stuff of phantasmagoria. Black men and yellow birds would materialise in the courtroom, and while the witches, in their corporeal forms, protested their innocence, their shapes would fly out and inflict injuries at will, safe in the knowledge that they were only visible to their victims. Then there was the touch test, whereby a suspected witch would be asked to lay hands on one of the children, who, invariably, would faint or fall into convulsions upon contact. It apparently didn't occur to the magistrates to question why a witch on trial for her life would perform her acts of cruel sorcery before the very people she was attempting to hoodwink. Then, of course, there is Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, 1953, a work that has consolidated the story in the popular mindset, for all the dramatic license taken by its author. Through such sundry retellings, we feel acquainted with the victims of this tragedy. Globally speaking, the events at Salem were relatively minor. But the tens of thousands who perished in witchcraft hysteria across medieval Europe seem somehow depersonalised by dint of sheer scale. One is reminded of the remark by the satirist Kurt Tucholsky, often falsely attributed to Joseph Stalin, "The death of one man, that is a catastrophe. 100,000 deaths, that is a statistic." It is, of course, deeply unfair to characterise the Puritans of New England as inveterate witch hunters. As the novelist Marilyn Robinson has noted, by the standards of 17th century Europeans, they showed remarkably little tendency to hunt witches, yet one lapse, repented of by those who had a part in it, has stigmatised them as uniquely inclined to this practice. For all that, the knowledge that Satan's minions were eternally hungry for innocent souls doubtless created the conditions in which the wild testimonies of the children could be accepted. Through their tears and ravings, these girls offered the villagers powerful confirmation of an already settled belief. The hysteria had begun in Salem Village, now known as Danvers, and had gradually spread to the towns of Salem, Andover, and Topsfield. It had all started with the fevered imaginations of 9-year-old Betty Paris, the daughter of the village clergyman, the Reverend Samuel Paris, and her cousin Abigail Williams, 2 years her senior. These two were the first to be afflicted, falling alternately into trances and fits, or making incoherent, otherworldly sounds. Often such episodes would come about during prayer, as though the girls were reacting against the power of the Holy Spirit. A local physician, William Griggs, ruled out epilepsy and proclaimed that an evil hand had fallen upon them. That Satan's talons had extended into the home of the local minister was a horrifying prospect for the devout and God-fearing population of Salem. In The Devil in Massachusetts, 1949, Marion L. Starkey attributes the behaviour of Betty Paris to her fear of eternal damnation, one instilled from birth in the full fervour of Calvinism. Abigail Williams, on the other hand, was said to be a rebellious girl who was desperate for some kind of outlet from the restrictive nature of the Puritan community. It is telling that when William Barker confessed to wizardry, he claimed that Satan had promised an end to resurrection and judgment, to punishment and shame. The doctrine of predestination meant that no individual could ever be certain whether they were among the elect or the damned. Arguably, the religious tenets of the community contributed to a repressive climate in which collective mania was always likely to gestate. The first to be accused of witchcraft was Tituba, one of the Reverend Paris's two household slaves. Betty and Abigail spent many hours in Tituba's company, and she would induct them in various magical rites and voodoo-like spellcasting she had picked up during her time in Barbados. No doubt little more than games, these harmless rituals took on a sinister quality after the girls began to show evidence of possession. Once Tituba had been accused, other obvious suspects presented themselves. Sarah Good was a local beggar woman with no social standing, and Sarah Osborne, although not poor, had excised herself from polite society due to her poor attendance at church and having taken a lover out of wedlock. Before long, the affliction had spread to other local girls who had associated with Betty and Abigail, and more witches were identified in the subsequent frenzy. By the time the trials came to an end, more than 200 people had been accused, 19 had been hanged, 5 others had perished in jail, and the farmer Giles Corey had been pressed to death with large boulders for refusing to enter a plea. In the throes of victimhood, these children had found the means to become the most powerful members of the community. They could see their fellow citizens executed on the basis of spectral evidence alone, what we might today refer to as lived experience. Those who attempted to apply reason and logic to the events as they unfolded were liable to find themselves accused. And so, for the sake of self-preservation, most left their doubts unuttered. The fantasies of the few were propagated by the elites, judges and ministers who had lost sight of reality or had no inclination to see it restored. One can barely fathom the impact these events must have had on local relationships. Starkey has noted how Puritan communities were prone to squabbles and feuds, as living up to so severe a creed put a strain on anyone's good temper. Petty rivalries were commonplace, not least because of territorial disputes. Under such circumstances, it is feasible that some would be willing to believe the very worst of their neighbours. The automatic forfeiture of land upon a conviction of witchcraft was surely an added incentive for those who wished to expand their property. But perhaps there is no need for such cynicism. It doesn't take any great anthropological prowess to understand that human beings have a tendency toward groupthink. By all accounts, Salem was a hotbed of minor contentions, a kind of powder keg that needed very little agitation before it would ignite. The villagers lived in a state of perpetual fear. There had been outbreaks of smallpox, and raids from indigenous tribes were a continual possibility. Even the weather may have had an impact on the collective mindset. The hysteria in Salem coincided with a particularly cold period, and with failing crops came a deterioration of economic prosperity. The economist Emily Oster has shown how witch hunts in history have tended to occur during periods of lower than average temperature, what climatologists refer to as little ice ages. Witches, after all, were said to be able to control the weather. What better way for the devil to wheedle his way into an already vulnerable population? With the recent rise of the New Puritans and their religion of social justice, there are many good reasons to reflect on the lessons of Salem. The willingness of the villagers to believe the girl's visions serves as a reminder of the human susceptibility to false narratives, particularly if they are more readily comprehensible than complicated truths. When bad ideas are allowed to spread unchecked, they take on an illusion of incontrovertibility. And when figures of authority are captured by dangerous ideologies, resistance becomes a feat of courage that few will dare to attempt. But perhaps the aspect of Salem most redolent to today's cultural skirmishes is the development of an intense climate of fear and mistrust. This episode in history offers a stark example of the conflicting loyalties and tribal instincts that can manifest in any society if the conditions are right. For those of us who have found ourselves caught in the culture wars of the present day, these parallels will be obvious. Such patterns recur wherever reason is abandoned and fear prevails, be that during the Red Scare of 1950s McCarthyism, or the ideological capture of today's major institutions, and the trickle-down orthodoxies this has inspired. Starkey's book, The Devil in Massachusetts, was written in the years directly following the Second World War, and so it is not surprising that she could discern that the medieval urge to hunt witches had been revived through replacing the medieval idea of malefic witchcraft by pseudoscientific concepts like race, nationality, and by substituting for theological dissension a whole complex of warring ideologies. The screams of the children of Salem never really stopped. They simply found other ways to reverberate. A frenzy of conformity. The association of our current culture wars with George Orwell's 1984 has become a predictable trope due to the way in which social justice activists so often redefine words to limit the possibility of debate. In addition to a reliance on a kind of newspeak, we see revisionist tactics and continual denials of reality that were anticipated in Orwell's Ministry of Truth. And when reading Orwell's account of the Ministry of Love, a concentration camp in which the thought police torture and brainwash dissidents, one cannot help but be reminded of the ferocity and lack of human empathy so often embodied by online zealots who favour axioms such as be kind and love wins. Yet for all the obvious comparisons that can be drawn between 1984 and the authoritarianism of the New Puritans, teachers who are looking for a literary precedent to explain the current culture wars could do little better than The Crucible. Miller wrote the play as an act of desperation at the height of the McCarthy era, and was especially troubled by the impact of powerful people who kept a strategic silence to ensure their survival. In an article for The New Yorker, Miller wrote that he was motivated in some great part by the paralysis that had set in among many liberals who, despite their discomfort with the Inquisitor's violations of civil rights, were fearful, and with good reason, of being identified as covert communists if they should protest too strongly. It's a familiar predicament. We are living through a frenzy of conformity, in which the opinions of a minority of activists are falsely presented by the media, political, and corporate classes as though they reflect an established consensus. The impact is being felt in all walks of life. For instance, after the seismic events of the summer of 2020, following the killing of George Floyd, an actor friend of mine was contacted by her agency because she had not posted anything on social media in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. She was told that she must do so immediately if she wanted casting directors to consider her for any future roles. I have heard many such anecdotes, but invariably they are communicated privately. There is a strong general feeling that to publicly object to the prevailing dogma is to jeopardize one's career and social standing. I have lost count of the number of emails from academics, artists, and media figures who have contacted me to express sympathy for my criticism of the New Puritans, but who admit that they could never endorse my sentiments in public for fear of cancellation. It is a circular problem that can only possibly be resolved if sufficient numbers speak out. This is the sad reality of most present-day working environments, where to utter a forbidden opinion, to misspeak, or even to fail to show due fealty to received wisdom, can be an impediment to future job prospects. As a former teacher, I am still in contact with ex-colleagues who are troubled by the sudden revisions made to curricula and pastoral policies. Many are being forced to undergo unconscious bias training, even though there is overwhelming evidence that such schemes are unreliable and ineffective. To raise a complaint is taken as proof of the kind of prejudice that the tests seek to expose. After all, only a witch would deny the existence of witchcraft. Many teachers are concerned about how such modifications have been rushed through with little consultation with parents or staff. One teacher told me about a school assembly conducted over the internet in the early days of the first coronavirus lockdown, in which pupils were berated for their white privilege. The Reverend Dr. Bernard Randall, a school chaplain at Trent College in Derbyshire, told me about training sessions in which staff were instructed to chant, "Smash heteronormativity." And when he delivered a sermon about the importance of respectfully challenging such ideological viewpoints, he was reported to prevent the government's anti-terrorism program. Other private schools have pledged their fealty to Black Lives Matter, despite the fact that this explicitly anti-capitalist movement objects to their existence and would presumably be happy to see these institutions razed to the ground. In a noble effort to be seen to address injustice, these schools are implementing divisive and contentious theories as though they are irrefutable truths. It hardly helps matters that the National Education Union, the largest teaching union in the United Kingdom, has said that there is an urgent need to decolonize every subject and every stage of the school curricula. In a recent report, the union calls for activist training for teachers. When it comes to bad advice, that takes some beating. With all the problems we currently face regarding the politicisation of the classroom and the influence of the New Puritans in our schools, the very last thing we need is more activist teachers pushing their fashionable but ultimately regressive agendas. Having drawn a number of parallels with the hysteria of Salem, it is worth emphasising that the New Puritans, in truth, bear little resemblance to the Puritans of old. Among the Puritans of New England, there existed a profound and pervasive consciousness of human fallibility and their unworthiness before God. This could not be further removed from today's social justice activists who, by and large, give the impression of never having questioned their own ideological certainties. While the Puritans of the 17th century remained forever uncertain whether they were among God's elect, the new Puritans seem to go about their business with a narcissistic lack of self-doubt. They have simplistically divided the world into sinners and saints, and have presumed that they ought to be grouped among the latter. Nor would the Puritans of New England have had much patience for the notion of redressing privilege. God had ordained the status and function of each of his creations, and it was not for them to challenge his reasons. If one was born in poverty, it was the will of God, and so efforts to achieve what we now call social mobility would have seemed potentially sacrilegious. Most importantly, the Puritans believed in the importance of mercy, which is why the judges in Salem were inclined to leniency for those who confessed to malefic witchcraft. In Calvinistic terms, the fall of man had meant that all were born sinful, which is why repentance rather than innocence was the condition for salvation. The cancel culture perpetuated by the new Puritans not only suggests a general disdain for the concept of mercy, but it also reinforces their perception of themselves as some kind of infallible elect. When I discuss what I call the new Puritans, therefore, I do not mean to imply a slur against Puritanism per se, perhaps most memorably achieved by H.L. Mencken's definition as the haunting fear that someone, somewhere, may be happy. I am not concerned with religious groups that emerged in post-Reformation England and sought to purge church practice of all vestiges of Roman Catholicism, such as clerical vestments or kneeling during the Eucharist. I am not referring to those who, under the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell, came to power after the English Civil War, or those who established colonies in America in the early 17th century and preached the Bible as the revealed word of God. I'm not referring to the belief that sports should be banned on the Sabbath, or that theatres are hives of corruption, or that drinking alcohol to excess is a sin, or that all sexual acts outside of wedlock are intrinsically disordered. Rather, I'm using an analogy, one that has been commonly recognised for more than a century, to denote those of a prohibitionist and precisionist tendency who seek to refashion society in accordance with their own ideological fervour. Above all, the title of this book is my attempt to find an accessible shorthand for these cultural revolutionaries who make every effort to reject all labels that are assigned to them. In the religion of social justice, we are facing a new kind of purity culture, one which is intolerant of any attempt to question its core tenets. To cavil at the convenient shorthand of Puritan in relation to such a movement makes about as much sense as complaining about how the ancient race of Philistines has become a byword for one who is ignorant of the significance of great art. What must such literal-minded quibblers make of the Samaritans, a charity that provides support for the emotionally distressed? Do they consider this name misleading, given that there is no reason to suppose that their namesakes in Bronze Age Palestine were similarly empathetic? When reading this book, pedants can console themselves with the knowledge that the word Puritan, as a synonym for intolerance and self-righteousness, actually predates the rise of the Puritan movement of early modern England. It was originally a pejorative term, which was eventually adopted by its targets, much like Tory and Whig. Later historians helped to cement the popular understanding of Puritans as killjoys. Thomas Babington Macaulay, for instance, claimed that the Puritans hated bear baiting not because it gave pain to the bear, but because it gave pleasure to the spectators. His account of their escalating intolerance after the accession of James I is starkly reminiscent of the new Puritans of today. After the fashion of oppressed sects, Macaulay writes, they mistook their own vindictive feelings for emotions of piety, and when they had worked themselves up into hating their enemies, imagined that they were only hating the enemies of heaven. Yet the analogy of the new Puritans is useful mostly because of what the concept of Puritanism has come to represent. Theirs is a belief in the perfectibility of humankind, The objective is not to critique society as it is, but to engineer an entirely fresh pseudo-reality through the imposition of limitations on language, thought, and perception. They seek to publicly shame those they consider dissidents and condemn all those who stray from the righteous path. Every day on social media, there is a fresh Hester Prynne to force onto the pillory steps. There are all sorts of ways in which lies gain currency. The hysteria of Salem is just one of the more evocative historical instances of people collectively fabricating a false reality and punishing those who fail to attest to its veracity. We are living through a period in which, much like the days when religious convictions were generally uncontested, articles of faith are peddled as truths by those in positions of power. The New Puritans, then, are best understood as a clergy for a godless age, presiding over a dreamscape of their own making, rewriting our language, history, and traditions as they go along. Yet, for all their clout, there are still some among us who steadfastly refuse to praise the elegance of the emperor's new clothes, who would rather point and laugh at the naked man in our midst. Not for the first time in human history, our way out of this madness will depend upon the heretics.